The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy, independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 25, Episode 5, I Am a Tinkerer, talking with Professor Dr. Ralph Hutt. The American Geophysical Union brings together 130,000 scientists and enthusiasts focused on atmospheric, ocean, hydrologic, space, and planetary research. Big issues, high science, and with that mission, you would expect the most advanced technology to be deployed. It would be the last place you would expect to encounter tinkerers who MacGyver their solutions to complex problems. MacGyver, of course, according to the Oxford Dictionary, means to make or repair something in an improvised or inventive way, making use of whatever items are at hand. MacGyver, of course, was a TV program where the star escaped life-threatening situations every week by forswearing firearms in favor of improvised engineering skills and cobbled together ingenuity. At the AGU annual conference in San Francisco in December, I found a group of scientists who were doing just that, relying on over-the-counter materials and personal creativity to make cost-effective devices to solve big geophysical problems. Chief among this band of innovators is Professor Ralph Hutt at the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands. He joins us from his office in Delft. Hello, Ralph, and welcome to the show.
Well, hello there, Jim.
Ralph, please take a few minutes to tell us about yourself and your work at the Technical University in Delft.
I'm an associate professor in hydrology and water management here in Delft, which means I get to do both research and teaching of our students, our future engineers. My research hinges on, let's keep it simple and say, two main pillars right now. One pillar is, I mean, I've always been a tool maker my entire career. And the current work that I do involves a lot of building of digital tools, which facilitate other scientists being able to more easily work with their own models and other people's models and big data sets on big cloud infrastructure. And I built the tool set you need to do that way more efficiently than you could do that in the past, opening up the opportunity to use all that tools for a lot of people. So that's one pillar. You have to think about things like predicting the impact of future climate change on local rivers, given different climate change scenarios, is something that you could then do with these tools. Mm-hmm. But the other one, and the one that you mentioned in your introduction, is that I work on and have my students work on developing low-cost sensors through MacGyvering so that we can measure anything related to water at a lower cost point. If you look outside, you can see that the Earth is highly diverse. So for us, it's very important that if we go out and measure, and we need these measurements to understand hydrological processes like rainfall, infiltration into the ground, evaporation. If we want to measure these processes, for us, it's usually beneficial to have multiple measurements over a region compared to one very highly detailed point measurement. So if we can, at the same price point, have many instruments instead of just having one expensive one, that would be beneficial to us. And I've been working for a great part of my career on doing that, using a very MacGyvered approach to it, seeing what the advances are in consumer electronics, seeing what the advances are that the maker movement, very strong in the Bay Area as well, by the way, but what the maker movement has achieved, and then seeing if we can leverage that to build these measurement devices, either measure stuff that we were already measuring but at a lower price point, or try to measure things that have never been measured before.
Let's go back to the beginning. How did you become interested in tinkering and the maker movement? And how does tinkering, the maker movement, feature in training and education of the young engineers that you're working with at Delft University?
It's a fun story how my career went and how I snowballed into tinkering, I guess. When I grew up, I mean, I had my Legos and stuff, but I was never the kid that took all the electronics apart at home to see how they function. And I was even clumsy at some point, you could say. I did do my master's in applied physics. I had some background in engineering from that. Mm-hmm. But then when I went to my PhD, I did a PhD that was very numerically focused. And then at some point during my PhD, I must have been like 24 by the time, a colleague of mine comes in and has me look at a video of someone that had recently hacked the remote control of the then popular Nintendo Wii game console. Uh-huh. This was the game console that you could like use the controller with motion detection to like play tennis or use as a steering wheel. That was pretty novel. And then someone, I think then at MIT, hacked the protocol that they used to communicate between the controller and the Wii itself, which basically turned out to be just Bluetooth. But he also understood what the ones and zeros meant. As someone in the maker movement, he made the great decision to publish that completely open online so that anyone could use it and build on that. Mm-hmm. This person, Johnny Lee, being a computer scientist, his first application of that was, oh, now I can use it to click through my PowerPoint slides. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, but when my colleague showed it to us, we together, this colleague, Stephen Weiss, he's now in Canada, also a professor in hydrology. And together we were like, we can use this. This thing has an infrared camera in there. Uh-huh. And we can use that to do measurements at a $40 price point that for a professional infrared camera would be way more expensive.
Of course.
So we built, and so we kept on doing our own PhDs that were more theoretical, but as a side project, we developed, like, can we do a measurement? And then we presented it at a conference just once. Mm-hmm. But you've been to AGU. If you walk the poster hall, it's an immense hall with A0. So those are, for metric aligned people, about 90 by 120. So I guess about 3 by 4 foot.
Right.
Posters with very dense scientific information. And then thousands of them in a big hall with scientists standing next to it trying to communicate about their results.
Right.
It can get overwhelming if you're there. And we had the benefit of having this actual device with us. Uh-huh. So we brought the device. It was just on a little table in front of us with a little funny ducky that we could trace the position of. And everybody just stopped by because it was not a normal poster. Mm-hmm. And including journalists stopping by. And then journalists started reporting on scientists use consumer electronics to do measurements. And from that point onwards, my career took a left side turn, and I've been doing that for years with great enjoyment.
Tell me, that particular device that you and your colleagues cobbled together, what was that used for? What practical application did that device have?
The measurement that we could do with it was we could measure very accurately water levels in what we call evaporation pans. Mm-hmm. So an evaporation pan is a standardized 1 square meter circular pan, metallic pan, that we use for reference evaporation measurements. When you're talking about millimeter or submillimeter levels of evaporation over time that you want to trace, so we would have a little float sitting in there with some LEDs on it, and then have the Wii remote focus on those little LEDs, and then we would just track where these LEDs were to make sure that we could determine the amount of water still left. So basically, it's a water level measurement.
I see.
But it allowed us to do it very accurately at a lower price point.
Mm-hmm. One of the devices that you exhibited at the last AGU meeting here in San Francisco in December was the rainwater Tomso device. Could you tell us about that? Because you were able to use your innovation, take it to Africa, and to measure rainwater and that sort of thing in Africa. Tell us about that specific invention, Tomso.
I'll have to make a few distinctions here. Tomso, T-A-H-M-O, is a project that has been run from Delft University and Oregon State for more over a decade now, with the specific goal to design, build, and make operational a network of weather stations in sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. I was involved in that at the start of the project, and one of the devices that was always making rain gauges, making weather stations expensive, was the rain gauge, especially since it always had water going through it that would clog it up, so that someone would need to come over and need to fix it. And so we thought about, can we not use the impact, the sound impact that drops make?
Yes.
To count drops. this is also, it's a good example because it also shows that these projects not always go as you want or as you hope. Uh-huh. We've spent the better part of a decade looking at, is it possible for us to make like a little drum where drops would fall off?
Yes.
And then we'll have a little piezo device in there. Those are the same 30-cent devices that are in alarm buzzers.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have that device in there to turn that vibration energy into electrical energy, and then we can measure it. And can we then, by the loudness of the sound of an individual drop, can we then determine how big the drop is, and hence can we determine how hard it rains?
Mm-hmm. You had on YouTube, there's a terrific video clip of you demonstrating this particular device. And first you start with, you know, drop 1, 2, 3 drops like that. And then all of a sudden you turn on a shower and there's like a huge downpour. And in the meantime, the device is picking up the sound of all of these drops. And so what was the practical application of that particular device? How in the field were you able to use that data for your next step in the project?
We moved on from that design to a design that doesn't measure the sound, but just measure the impact time between drops, which turned out to be a better way of measuring rainfall. That allows us to make a relatively cheap rain gauge. We've been deploying these rain gauges and also a lot of different varieties of rain gauges in sub-Saharan Africa. In the project that we're doing there, that rain gauge data gives on the ground information about the amount of rain that falls.
Mm-hmm.
That feeds, that has multiple uses in our field of science. The main use that most people will recognize is that it feeds basically into our weather prediction.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what the weather today was like, if you know exactly what the weather today is like, it's easier to predict what the weather tomorrow will be.
Mm-hmm.
So the more measurements you have of the weather today, the easier it will be to predict accurately what the weather tomorrow will be. We feed these measurements that we have into the global institutional systems that run weather predictions.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps us to basically improve, and we currently have a PhD working on that, to use all these now 600 sub-Saharan African stations to come up with better predictions of rainfall in sub-Saharan Africa and get the lead time from like 3 days to like 7 days, which would be immense for farmers on the ground to make decisions on how they operate their farms. But it's also basic things like deciding if a soccer match will take place or not. Mm-hmm.
Let me just ask you, where does this data feed into? Because if you have 600 of these measuring stations around Africa, there are 52 countries in Africa, so you have many countries and that sort of thing. Where does this data feed into? Is it like a global organization, a weather organization? Who gets the data and how is it shared on the ground in Africa?
So currently we're in the process of like validating that data and making sure that the data is of a quality enough that it will feed into these weather systems. But to give you an insight in how this world of weather prediction works, there are multiple global spanning networks of observations. Most of them, but not all, but most of them feed directly into systems operated by the World Meteorological Organization. I think all countries of the world are member states of the WMO.
Mm-hmm.
WMO then distributes the results of all these measurements to all their member states.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a few organizations around the world that basically run very intensive, requiring supercomputers, very intensive numerical models for weather to do the entire weather prediction for the entire Earth. And I know that in Europe, this is done by an institute called ECMWF, and most European countries are member states of that. It stands for the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecast. And I sometimes mix up my American institute, but I think it's NCAR that does this for the US, but it could be the NWS, the National Weather Service, that does this for the US. But I do know that all of these institutes in the U.S. work very closely together.
Mm-hmm. That's very impressive. I mean, to start with so modestly and now have it deployed across 620 stations in Africa, you're doing your validations, and eventually that's going to feed into the global weather system. That's great work.
The funny thing about that is that the actual sensor on the stations in sub-Saharan Africa is not necessarily exactly the same that the one that we pitched 10, 11 years ago. Because what we did when we started, no, it's more than 11 years ago. Yeah, I'm getting old. But so what we did when we started pitching that is we were not necessarily interested in people have in having that particular sensor be the end solution for everyone that wants to measure rain. Mm-hmm. What we wanted is to change a culture in how people look at measuring rain and realize we should get these devices cheaper so we can get more devices on the ground at the same price point. And that is what I'm very proud of, to have been a small gear in the entire machine, is that that culture has made sure that the type of sensors that are now being developed take this into account.
So were you able to commercialize the first device that you created?
No, to great pains. We've tried. I've been in the startup business. We got pretty far in getting the device functioning.
Yes.
But it does turn out that a business also needs a market.
Yes.
And so I'm a tool builder and an engineer. And so the marketing parts of the market parts basically killed us. What I am happy about is I've learned a lot about how startup and product design, et cetera, worked. But what I'm really happy about is, one, the device still lives in the sense that there's now an open source version that people can manufacture themselves. So all the knowledge that we built, we're a public institution. A lot of that knowledge was built using tax money. Yes. All that knowledge is now publicly available for people to build these devices, even though there's not a market big enough to sustain a company around that, it's at least the knowledge didn't go to waste. So I'm really happy about that.
Are you working on any other project at this point that is as groundbreaking as that rain measurement gauge for Africa?
Most of my research work is more on the sphere of digital tools to help other people work together more easily. I'm the principal investigator, the project lead on the e-water cycle project, where we build a platform that let hydrologists, people that calculate and study the movement of water over the earth, that let them work together with each other's models. That's going to be groundbreaking, but it's going to be groundbreaking within a certain community. And then the output of that would be better flood predictions, better insight in the hydrology and the impact of climate change on hydrology. So the impact of that will be felt in the world, but the groundbreakingness of that will mostly be recognized by a smaller group of colleagues, I hope. But that doesn't mean that I've put down my soldering iron, because I'm doing, well, two more things. I'm teaching undergrad maker education in Delft, which is amazing to do. So I'm passing on these MacGyvering skills to 18, 19-year-olds incoming physics students. That's one. And I just mean, if you could look around my room where I'm standing right now, there's multiple projects that are not science related but are very much MacGyvering. I'm looking at one of the I bought a classic hand-shaped traffic light that you have in the U.S.
I bought it at
a U.S. dump, and so I'm standing here and I'm trying to get that connected to the setup in my house so that if I want to raise my hand in an online meeting, it actually lights up behind me. And I think that's an important point about tinkering and MacGyvering. So like I said, I now teach maker education to undergraduate physics students, and they learn about how to properly go through the steps of the design cycle, how to do that in a structured way, how to properly incorporate their knowledge of physics that they learned in other courses into a design. They learn about soldering, 3D printing, laser, all kind of fabrication technology that I get to teach them. And I am pretty sure that the people that take my undergrad physics class, a lot of them will end up in McKinsey style consultancy. And they will never for their work use what I taught. However, if in the weekends they make projects like I just described, I still think it's been a very valuable part of their educational upbringing.
Tell me, when these young men and women, these young engineering students arrive at Technical University Delft, and of course, probably many of them don't have a maker background, a tinkering background. What is their first reaction when you introduce them to the soldering iron and making do with commercially available materials, etc.? What is their first reaction? Are they surprised? Are they engaged? Tell me.
So we have about 180 incoming students a year.
Yes.
And I get 180 different reactions. So a lot of them are like, finally, because I teach that in the third quarter of the academic year. And in the first two quarters, they get a lot of theoretical courses. Mm-hmm. And they come to Delft to become an engineer. So you get actually a title as engineer when you graduate with a bachelor or a master, with a master's from Delft. You may call yourself an engineer. And so they say, oh, finally, now we can make some stuff. So that's a portion of my students. Mm-hmm. Another portion of my student indeed comes in with, ooh, do we have to like do stuff with our hands now? We make sure that we build up the way that course is built up with like first projects that are very close to what they already know, and then yes. they incorporate a little bit of making, and it builds up to building amazing physics demo. It's, I think, a very important part of it is just establishing a culture very early on. For example, what we do, we start the course in a lecture room because you have to give one of these introductions where you say, welcome, this is the course, this is what we're going to do.
Yes.
Normally, these lecture rooms have like four doors where you can enter. We close three of them, so they have to enter through one door. And then we'll have a table standing there, and then they come in, and they will get a starter package from us that includes an Arduino and some springs and some stuff that they will need. And then on top of that, we hand them physically, and this is your roll of duct tape. And we do that with all 180 students, uh-huh. just to like make sure this is a course where you will need duct tape to be able to build the kind of stuff that we're doing. Uh-huh. Those kind of small things helps to set the culture that you want to establish in your education.
Yes.
It also helps to get a lot of duct tape on walls in our university that the building maintainers are not happy with.
Well, Ralph, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts? You've already told us how the students are relating to this maker culture, but what are your closing thoughts about ensuring that maker culture becomes even more widespread in our engineering faculties and our universities?
My closing thoughts for this podcast are that having a piece of maker education fits in any type of education. And I think I can make a point for even doing that when you're being trained as a financial accountant or something. Because the skills you learn in maker education, in doing design engineering, is to apply the knowledge that you learned in other courses in a structured way to arrive at a solution that fixes a problem that you had, or that creates an art object that didn't exist yet, but that you wanted to exist. And so learning that structured way of thinking, learning that structured way of approaching a problem is beneficial to all students, especially engineering students, of course. And I think it's very important that we recognize that the only way that maker education can be successful is if we recognize that it builds on knowledge students already get in other courses. I could not do my course if it weren't for those theoretical courses my student gets before that. It builds in a curriculum, and you need to work together on building that curriculum. You cannot start from scratch mm-hmm. with maker education. But I think it has a very important place in any education.
And Ralf, are you working on any new projects that are Tinker and maker inspired?
Yeah. I'm actually, for the first time, because I still want to learn, I've never made my own printable circuit board, like design it and send it to a factory and then get it in your own hands. Mm-hmm. So as a learning process for myself, I am now building a distortion effect. So designing it myself, building it, testing it, a distortion effect for a musical instrument like guitars. Mm. And the idea is that once this is finished, I'll turn it into some kind of set where people can then order the printable circuit board, can order the components and solder it themselves. And that could be a educational opportunity for musicians and guitar players on learning how to solder while in the process of that, ending up with a useful device that they can use for making their music.
Very impressive. Ralf, how can our listeners follow you? Do you have a website? What is your X handle?
I got a website. I'm on X, but I have a website. It's just my name, but then .nl for Netherlands. And I'll probably move to one of the future X's as soon as it is clear which one will win this war of the social platforms. Sure. Google certainly knows to find.
But for the time being, do you actually have an X account that you use?
It's just my name, but I'm not that active anymore.
At Rolf. And you had mentioned Oregon State, that you worked in collaboration with them. Do they have an X handle?
They must have. All universities have big media departments that do this.
Well, Rolf, I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning from Delft in the Netherlands and for sharing with us a very practical approach to the theoretical sciences. And so often when we think of engineering, we think of the theory. You're actually applying the theory in a very practical fashion. Very much enjoyed meeting you when you were here at the American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco, and hope that our paths cross again.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a joy talking to you and talking about my work. So thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And for our listeners, today's episode is number 492. Listen to us on Apple Podcast, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms in total, with listeners in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.